any bride. But when the bride is almost old enough to be the mother of a bride, well, it's not pretty.
Oh, jeez, look at me,
I said, staring into the compact I'd pulled from my carry-on bag after Bob and I stepped onto the first of many moving sidewalks that would carry us to baggage claim, and seeing my own bloodshot eyes staring back. Why did I bother to bring a suitcase? I could have packed 2 weeks' worth of clothes in the bags under my eyes. I look like a bride, all right. Bride of Frankenstein.
So that makes me the monster?
Bob asked as we stepped onto the next moving sidewalk. I lowered the mirror and looked at my husband. His chin was stubbly, a chunk of hair was sticking out at a weird angle from the top of his head, and his rumpled shirt, sporting a stain from marinara sauce he'd consumed somewhere between Rome and New York, looked like he'd slept in it, which he had. No, you look great, and very handsome, I said. And to me, he was.
Well, I think you look beautiful, Bob said. Like the Mona Lisa and Venus de Milo rolled into one, except with arms.
Well, that's a relief, I said, wrapping both of mine around his neck before giving him a kiss. I love you, Mr. Smith.
And I love you, Mrs. Smith. In fact, I love you so much, he said, lowering his voice into that sexy little growl that he knows melts my butter. That when we get home, I am going to make mad, passionate love to you. It'll be the best you've ever had.
Really? Better than that first night in Rome? Better than the boat on Lake Como? Or the balcony in Portofino? Better than in Naples, in Florence, in Milan, in Venice?
Better than all of them,
he said, pulling me close, staring hungrily into my bloodshot eyes.
Better than all of them put together.
Wow, I said, a smile tugging at the corners of my mouth. And when are you going to do this?
Right after I get home, he said, and sleep for a week.
He groaned and all but collapsed in my arms, limp as a rag doll. I laughed out loud and kissed him again. And when we exited the door from the gate area to the terminal, I laughed again. We both did. So hard. Alex, Zoe, and Jean Smith, Bob's mom, and the best mother-in-law on Earth, who had come up from San Diego to keep an eye on the kids and Desmond while we were on our honeymoon, were standing just outside the door, wearing bedsheet togas over their clothes and waving little Italian flags over their heads. Desmond was there, too, panting and thumping his tail, wearing a circle of plastic leaves on his head that was supposed to be a crown of laurels. They were so cute and funny and silly, and, best of all, they were mine. My family. My kids. 17-year-old Alex, now 2 heads taller than me and with legs that went on forever, had survived his morose and moody phase. He and Bob went running together every Saturday morning, then went to the screen door for fried chicken and waffles. Alex still ran cross-country and had qualified for regionals in his sophomore year, gone to state in his junior year. He just returned from a week-long running camp at the University of Oregon. Alex was a good athlete, a good student, a good boy, most of the time. And even when he wasn't, I was proud of him. Zoe, now 15, could still be a royal pain in the butt, but not as often as before. She was actually starting to think about life after high school and was more sensible about boys now, less needy and prone to heartbreak. That was a good thing because there were a ton of them pursuing her. I was glad to have Bob in the picture. Any boy who wanted to take Zoe out first had to meet and pass muster with Bob, who pulled them aside and, with a heavy hand on the kid's shoulder and menacing smile on his face, explained exactly what would happen to him if he disrespected or hurt Zoe, and didn't have her home by 10. Zoe ran toward me, waving her flag over her head and shouting, "Ciao, Bella!" She hugged me so hard I could barely breathe. "Wow," I said when she let me go and threw herself into Bob's arms, hugging him just as hard. "That was some greeting. Did you miss us?"
"So much," she chirped. "What did you bring me?"
"Uh-huh, I see how it is."
"Don't worry," I laughed. "We've got presents for everybody. Jean, your son picked out a Fendi handbag for you that's going to make you drool."
"Oh, honey," she said, grinning as Bob hugged her hello. "You didn't have to do that. What color is it?"
Alex, who had been hanging back a little, came forward, gave Bob one of those manly handshake backslap things, then one arm hugged me before taking my bag from my shoulder and carrying it toward the escalator. "How was camp?" I asked as we walked.
"Good," he said. "Really good. And I've got some good news."
"Oh, yeah? What?"
"I'll tell you later, in the car. First, how was Italy? Bet you were sad to leave, eh?"
I looped my arm loosely around his waist. "Italy was fantastic. Amazing," I said. "But it's great to be home. Really, really great."
Chapter 44. Nan. Brianna, Emily, and I were sitting at the patio table, splitting a bottle of wine and eating bruschetta made from the first of the summer tomatoes and basil. James and Dan were ferrying back and forth from the kitchen to the deck, carrying platters, plates, pitchers, and bowls to the table. Matt and Kyle were standing by the barbecue, conferring about the doneness of the steaks and burgers, which I reminded them mustn't touch my veggie burgers. Barefoot grandkids and barking dogs were galloping all over the yard, hooting and whooping and sometimes somersaulting across the wet grass, having the time of their lives. So was I. The second weekend of July has always been our homecoming week, when all my kids and grandkids, well, almost all, come to Portland for 8 days of food, fun, and family time. It's my favorite week of the entire year. Now doubly so, because during last year's homecoming Saturday barbecue, Malcolm and I were married. The ceremony was casual and perfectly lovely. I wore a simple white sheath overlaid with crocheted lace and carried pink roses from the garden. Malcolm wore a khaki summer suit with a white shirt and pink tie. Blixen wore a pink silk bow around her neck, and Nelson and Stuart had baths. Later, after the champagne had been poured and the pictures taken, Malcolm changed out of his suit and joined in the grandkids' annual game of tag. When he suggested the addition of sprinklers and dogs to the game, the kids started calling him Grampy. They just love Malcolm. So do I. Our life together is incredibly rich and full. But unlike before, when I filled my days with activity as a means of staving off loneliness, now my life is filled with activities I truly enjoy, including vegging out, as Malcolm calls it. Yes, with Malcolm's help, I have actually learned the value of sitting still and doing absolutely nothing. But that's not all we do. We travel quite a bit. Malcolm has a little teardrop trailer that we've taken on camping trips to the beach, the mountains, and Glacier National Park in Montana. For our honeymoon, we took it down to Ashland and spent a whole week at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. That was fantastic. I can't wait to go back. In the fall, we're planning a trip to Scotland to visit Malcolm's relatives. It will be my first overseas trip. I'll probably need a prescription for some anti-anxiety medicine, but with Malcolm's help, I know I can do it. I'm very excited. We do a lot here in Portland, too. Stuart and Nelson are both certified therapy dogs now, so we visit local hospitals and nursing homes and are on call in crisis situations. And, of course, we're both still involved with Rainbow Gate. The third annual Dog Mother's Ball raised close to $10,000. We moved it to an outdoor event venue in Oregon City for the second year. That way we can accommodate more people, and we have a whole staff of professionals to handle the actual event, meaning Malcolm doesn't have to climb ladders to deal with dicey electrical wiring anymore, and we have more time to do other things we enjoy. I bought Malcolm a little 18-foot sailboat as a wedding present, and we both took lessons. Sailing with your husband, I have learned, is a real test of a marriage. But in spite of that incident with the jib sheet and the yelling and the boom, we're still together. And in spite of the results of Malcolm's recent prostate biopsy, results that we aren't ready to share with the kids just yet, we're incredibly happy and fortunate. If someone had told me 3 years ago that I would be happily married to the most wonderful man on earth, I'd have said they were dreaming. Now I'm living that dream. Whatever we have to face, we'll face together. Life is good. Malcolm waved his arm over his head, beckoning me to leave my comfortable seat on the patio and join in the game. "Come on in, honey. The water's fine." And immediately, the grandkids started chorusing, "Come on, Grammy, come play." "After lunch," I promised, looking down at the pink bundle in my lap. "I'm having a pretty good time right here at the moment." When we married, I had 8 grandchildren and Malcolm had 3. This new addition, Ellie, gives us an even dozen. Yes, life is very good. Chrissy, who was in the kitchen making a salad, poked her head out the door. "Mom, are you getting tired of holding her?" "Never," I said, looking down at this perfect little person, placing my finger in her palm and smiling as the 5 tiny fingers curled around mine. "We should be ready to eat in about 15 minutes. What time do you think Monica and Bob will show up? Should I hold off serving until they get here?" "Well, Monica said they were coming, but they only got home last night. I'm sure they're so jet-lagged they'll probably sleep right through the barbecue, but hopefully not Grace's opening." For a moment, I considered getting up, calling Monica's house, and leaving a message reminding them about the opening, but decided I'd wait a few more hours before disturbing the honeymooners. The opening started at 5. There was still plenty of time. Baby Ellie stirred in her sleep, yawned and stretched, clenching her tiny fists as she lifted her arms over her head, then opened her eyes and blinked, gazing at me with a solemn expression. "You're awfully serious for someone who's only 6 weeks old," I said, lowering my face closer to hers. "You don't look as if you approve of me one bit." Ellie blinked again, as if confirming my observation. I looked at my daughters. "Honestly, have you ever seen a baby so serious? I think she's sitting here right now, judging every one of us, and wondering when her real family is coming to claim her." Emily laughed, then got up from her chair and looked over my shoulder at her newest niece. "Sorry, kiddo. It's not a bad dream. We really are your family." Brianna grinned. "Jake was like that. Don't you remember, Mom? He always used to..." My cell phone, which was sitting on the table, rang. Brianna stopped in the middle of her sentence. Emily held out her arms. "Here, Mom, I'll take her." In the 2 years I'd had my phone, it had rung less than a dozen times, but I continued to carry it with me everywhere I went, making sure it was always charged and within arm's reach, the ringer turned up as high as it would go. Everyone in the family knows why. Of those dozen calls from Danny, probably half were requests for food or clothing, and once for a ride to the doctor when she caught bronchitis. The others, in spite of the conditions I'd laid out to Danny, were stoned, panicked, often incoherent conversations, in which she either demanded or pleaded for me to give her money. Those calls were hard to take, painful to listen to, but I was grateful for every call, because at least I knew that Danny was still alive. I was sure this call would be the same as all the others, brief and largely uneventful, but my heart was hammering just the same. It always does when Danny calls. Hope dies hard in a mother's heart. I handed the baby to Emily and picked up the phone, walking quickly toward one of Malcolm's hosta beds before answering the call, turning my back so the girls wouldn't be able to overhear my conversation. "Danny?" "Hi, Mom." She sounded nervous, subdued and anxious, but coherent. "Hi, sweetheart. How are you? Do you need something?" "No, I just... Mom, I overdosed yesterday." "Oh, Danny. Oh, my God," I said, my words a prayer, tears springing to my eyes. "It's okay, Mom. Really, I'm okay. That's not why I'm calling. The policeman who found me, the one who called the ambulance, came around today and said there was a rehab spot open for me if I wanted to take it. I decided I do. I want to stop, to get my life back. Oh, honey. Danny, that's wonderful. Mom, it's okay. Don't cry. It's all right, I said, wiping my eyes with my sleeve. It's happy crying. Well, don't start dancing a jig just yet, she said, and I could hear the smile in her voice, the first time I'd heard that in years. It's going to be hard. A lot of people who go into rehab still don't make it. I know, but you will, Danny. You're strong, and you're ready. I am, she said quietly. I really think I am. Honey, do you want me to come get you? I could drive you there, bring you some clothes. No, Mom, not right now. You can visit in a few weeks, but I need to do this on my own, okay? Okay, I said, bobbing my head and blinking back tears. I'll be praying for you, sweetheart. So will Malcolm. Thanks, Mom. I'll need it. Can I tell your brothers and sisters? Everybody's here. Oh, that's right. It's homecoming, she said, the sound of her smile making my heart sing. Yeah, you can tell them. Tell them that I said hello, and that next year I'll be at the barbecue. I will, Danny. I'll tell them.
Chapter 45. Grace. Grace, is this good or do you want it higher? I turn from the table where I've been pouring bottles of ginger ale and pink lemonade into the punch bowl and look up to see my husband standing on a ladder and holding a rope. Can you bring it up about a foot? I think it looks better when they're hanging at different heights. Luke pulls the rope, raising the bar and the quilt that's hanging on it, then turns and looks at me again. That's perfect. Thanks, honey. Luke ties off the rope and climbs down the ladder. I come over and stand next to him. That's the last one, he says. It looks good, Gracie. Really good. You should feel proud of yourself. I turn in a circle, looking at the 20 quilts hanging along the brick walls of the warehouse, the quilt I made for Jamie, with the stars and stories that always make me smile, hangs next to an extraordinary quilt, a portrait of a man's face pieced entirely from neckties by a woman who is married to an executive. On the opposite wall, I see a quilt of red, white, and blue by the wife of a veteran, another made entirely from race T-shirts and embellished with medals and blue ribbons by the husband of a woman who ran marathons, and a crib-sized quilt with pastel pink angel blocks embellished with rosebuds and ribbons made by a young mother. So many quilts, all different, all beautiful, all made to celebrate the life and memory of someone deeply loved and never forgotten. Looking at them, I can't help but smile, but I don't say anything. Portland truly is my home now, but the mark of my Midwestern upbringing will stay with me for life. Where I come from, you don't brag about your accomplishments, and you don't say you feel proud of yourself, even when you do. I'm proud of us, I say, rising up on my toes and kissing Luke on the cheek. And I am. It's a big day for both of us. 3 months ago, Luke and I bought this building, a 3-story, 12,000-square-foot warehouse in East Portland. Even though Luke and I got a good return on my condo and his bungalow, we had to take out a mortgage, a big one. When we went to sign the papers, my hands were shaking, I was so nervous, a feeling that didn't dissipate for about a month. But now that the remodeling is finally done, and we're only an hour from opening our doors to 100 friends, associates, and family members, I feel happy and completely at peace with our decision. We're doing the right thing, for ourselves, and a lot of other people as well. The top floor of the building has 2 loft apartments. Luke and I live in one and rent out the other. That's where most of the remodeling took place. Honestly, I thought it was fine as it was. Not a palace, but definitely habitable. But Luke? Well, let's just say that we now have the most beautiful kitchen cabinets and built-in bookshelves on the east side. The bottom floor has a storage space, a big industrial-sized garage, and Luke's workshop and showroom. He employs two other carpenters now and is looking to hire another one, or maybe take on an apprentice. Though he has more orders than he can fill and could definitely make more money if he had more help, Luke won't compromise on the quality of his work. He's starting to think training apprentices is the only way he'll be able to maintain the standard of workmanship he insists on. The second floor, where we are now, houses my workshop and offices. Twirl and Whirl Clothing Company, now Twirl and Whirl Workshop, has 6 employees, including me. Billy is in charge of the actual workshop floor, sewing dresses and supervising 3 additional seamstresses we were able to hire after we got into the space. Janet works in the office with me. I brought her on about a year ago to help with online marketing, order fulfillment, shipping, bookkeeping, and anything else that needs doing. Janet and I have pretty much the same job description. We have a really great team in place. They're not just good workers. They're good people who really believe in the mission. Every person who works here gets a vote on where our donated dresses will go. So far, we've made 1,000 dresses to encourage women in need or transition. By this time next year, if our projections are right, that number will be 5,000. Some are sent to homeless shelters, others to shelters for victims of domestic violence, some to the Red Cross to be given to women who lost everything after a house fire or natural disaster, and some to an organization that helps women re-entering the workforce by making sure they have something nice to wear to job interviews. Kim, one of our new employees, recently came up with a new idea. It meant a little extra design work on my part, but I'm really excited about it. Twirl and Whirl is now making children's dresses. In September, we'll donate 75 dresses so girls in foster care can have something new and nice to wear on the first day of school. It's just a pilot project, but it feels like the start of something pretty wonderful. I still have a sewing machine on the workshop floor, a much faster industrial machine than my old one, and manage to spend a few hours there each week, but not as much as I'd like. I'm not complaining. There are worse problems for a business to have than being so overwhelmed by demand that you have to bring on more people to make the product. Besides, it means I have time for some of the other things I care about. Billy and I have gotten to be really good friends. After we finished our quilts, she told me about another woman at her grief support group and asked if we could help her make a quilt. Of course, I said yes. Things just kind of grew from there. Now, every Thursday from 6 to 9 at night, we meet here on the workshop floor to help people make quilts and tell stories of the people they love and miss. Sometimes Nan and Blixen drop by. I think it helps people. The way I can tell is, though people are welcome to come for as long as they want, once they finish their quilts, they gradually stop coming. That's why we decided to have this little quilt exhibition in conjunction with our building opening, so people who've moved on have a chance to keep in touch. I think it's good that we need a reunion. Staying isn't what we're created for. Besides the business and the quilting group, the other focus of my time is, of course, Luke. With 2 businesses growing by leaps and bounds, it's very hard for us to make time for each other. We really have to work at it. That's been the biggest challenge in our 16 months of marriage. Part of the reason we decided to take the leap and buy the warehouse is because we thought being able to live where we work would make it easier to spend time together. So far, it's working out. But some of that is Luke's doing. When we first moved in, he said, "I have an idea for a project. Let's make love in every single room of this building."
"All 12,000 square feet?" I asked.
"All 12,000 square feet, including this stairwell," he said, then sat down on the bottom step and pulled me down on top of him.
It's gotten to be our little joke. Every time we make love, we talk about the project. Sometimes when we're out to dinner with friends or visiting their house, Luke will say, "Well, we'd better get going. Grace and I have this project we're working on." It's really kind of cute and also kind of sexy. It's fun sneaking off like that, having people think we're going off to work, but knowing that the second we get back to the house, we're We're going to jump on each other. It's our inside joke. But to tell the truth, I think people are catching on. A few weeks ago, Monica said, "Boy, Luke sure has a lot of projects in the works," then winked at me. Well, what can I say? It's a big building. Billy, Janet, and Ed, one of Luke's carpenters, came early to help us set up. The guests started arriving promptly at 5. Nan, Malcolm, and their clan, including kids and grandkids, showed up first. Nan immediately pulled me aside to share the good news about Danny. "Oh, Nan, that is wonderful," I said, and gave her an enormous hug. "It is," she said. "But pray for her, will you? It won't be easy." "I will," I promised. "Every day." The kids were running all over the place, bouncing with energy. We didn't mind. We'd put the sewing machines in the storage room, so there really wasn't anything they could break. James, Nan's oldest son, organized a game of sardines, so that kept them busy. Once things settled down, I asked Chrissy if I could hold baby Ellie. "She's gorgeous," I said, cooing over Ellie's tiny fingernails and breathing in that sweet milk and baby shampoo smell. "She is," Chrissy agreed. "Really, I thought Bill and I were done with kids, but, you know," she shrugged. "Sometimes life has other plans. She's the best surprise we ever got." I'll say, I could have held that little sweetheart all night. But when I heard a booming voice from the door yelling, "Grace, ciao, bella," I handed the baby back to Chrissy and ran to give Monica a hug. "Ciao, how was the honeymoon? Was Italy all you hoped for and more?" "So much more," Monica gushed. "Rome was great, but oh, Grace, Venice and Verona, Portofino, so romantic. And the food, Grace, the food was just phenomenal. You have never in your life had pasta this good. And the sauces, I don't know what it is, either the tomatoes or the olive oil or the atmosphere, but you haven't eaten marinara until you've eaten it in Italy. Wait until we show you the pictures. We only took about 1,000. "All of food," Bob joked, putting his arm around Monica's waist. "We really did have a great time. We've already decided to go back for our 3rd anniversary and bring the kids." "Oh, and we came home to some very good news," Monica said. "One of the coaches from U of O pulled Alex aside at his cross-country camp and invited him for a campus visit in the fall." "Really?" I said. "You think they might offer him a scholarship?" "Well, first he has to get in," Monica said practically. "But you never know. Oh, and Zoe wanted me to ask you. Could you use an intern this summer? Unpaid, of course. She's thinking about studying fashion. At least, this week." Monica laughed. "I thought working with you might help her figure out if she's serious about it or not." "Sure," I said. "Have her call me. I can always use an extra pair of hands." My mom and Aunt Ricky were next to arrive. I flew them out for the opening and booked them into a nice hotel downtown for the weekend, to be followed by a tour of the Oregon wine country and 2 more days at the beach. They hadn't had a sister's getaway in years and seemed to be having a terrific time. Mom couldn't wait to tell me about their visit to Blue Star Donuts. "Gracie, they were so delicious, but they had the strangest flavors. Blueberry bourbon basil. Would you believe it? Bourbon in a donut."
"Personally," Aunt Ricky said, "I've always preferred my bourbon in a highball glass. That's why I'm in charge of tomorrow's field trip. We're going to the Multnomah Whiskey Library. It's right near the donut place. Want to come?"
"Thanks, Aunt Ricky, but I've given up drinking. How about Luke and I take you and Mom for an early dinner? Tasty and Alder doesn't take reservations, but it's worth the wait. I've actually had dreams about their skillet corn cake, and the radicchio with bacon lardons and egg is so good, I've been known to order one as an appetizer and then order it again for dessert." "You always did know the best places to eat," she said, "even after you lost all that weight. Why don't you let me pay for dinner? You and Luke have already done too much. The airline tickets, the hotel." "No," I said, This trip is our treat. Thanks to you, we can afford it.
Oh, posh. All I did was co-sign for the loan. I knew you'd be good for it.
Aunt Ricky craned her neck, looking all around the workshop.
And I was right. You must be doing well to afford all this.
Most of this is mortgaged, I laughed. But we are doing well. But that first loan helped me sell enough dresses so the bank would loan us money to expand. We could never have done it without you. I think that's probably worth a trip and a dinner, don't you? It was a wonderful party. I felt so happy for so many reasons. Diane Maestro, the woman who made the quilt from her husband George's ties, came and brought her sister-in-law. They stood in front of George's portrait and cried, but they were good tears. Becky Jones and her husband, Roger, came and brought their parents to see the crib quilt Becky made. It was sweet to see Becky and Roger standing together in front of the quilt, holding hands. After a few minutes, Luke came up behind me and whispered in my ear, "Should I get Becky a chair or something? She looks like she's going to deliver that baby any minute." "She's okay," I said. "Still has a month to go." Luke wrapped his arms around my waist, then kissed me on the neck. "You are one incredible woman, Grace. Do you know that? Look at all these people you've brought together. Look at all these lives you've impacted."
"You mean the lives we've impacted? If you hadn't stocked me in Starbucks, or built me a sewing table, or taught me to dance, it would still be just me and Maisie, living in the condo and hiding from life. Credit where credit is due, mister."
"Okay, fine. I helped with some of it," he said, squeezing me. "But the quilts are all you. I can't even sew on a button."
"Yes, I know," I laughed. "But you have other skills."
I placed a hand on top of his and moved it low over a small, new swell at my waistline.
"I was thinking, I might want to make another quilt. One about that size."
I pointed to Becky's pink and white crib quilt, then waited for Luke to pull the pieces together. Honestly, it took a little longer than I thought it would. Finally, after about 6 seconds of silence, he let go of my waist and took hold of my shoulders, turning me toward him. His eyes were wide.
"Wait. What? Grace, really?"
I nodded and my face split into a goofy, joyous grin that mirrored his.
"Really?"
he said again.
"How?"
I laughed.
"What do you mean, how?"
"No, I meant, you know, when?"
"Well, I can't be entirely sure. You've been pretty aggressive about the project, but I'm pretty sure it was in the stairwell."
"The stairwell? You mean the very first night?"
Luke wrapped his arms around my waist, lifted me off the floor, and swung me in a circle.
"What did I tell you when I first saw this building? Didn't I tell you it was lucky?"
I looped my arms around Luke's neck and laughed. Laughed for joy and life and complete, perfect, incandescent happiness.
"You know what else is lucky?" I asked, then kissed him again. "Me."
This concludes the reading of Just in Time by Marie Bostwick. Copyright 2018 by Marie Bostwick. This book was read by Emily Sutton Smith, Kate Marson, and Carol Monda. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.